On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, thank you for joining us. This is ITRC's online training, Remediation Management of Complex Sites. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to the ITRC trainers. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we're getting started. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. The trainers are going to control the slides during today's training class. If you would like to control your own slides, you can do that by downloading the presentation. And that's back on the CLUIN training page where you started today. Throughout today's training, we do look forward to your participation. You're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A box in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, we're going to ask some of those questions out loud. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to ask questions out loud, but we do ask that you hold questions until those question and answer breaks if you're on the phone line. And also leave your phone on mute so that we don't pick up background noise. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone on the call fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. This is the first time we're offering today's course to the public. We're also developing new courses, and your feedback helps us improve our offerings. The feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate of participation. So be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We do encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. There's a wide variety of guidance documents available. We have our online schedule planned out for 2018. There's also the opportunity to join teams. So if you're interested in becoming more involved in ITRC, it's a great opportunity for you right now to become more involved. I'll introduce our trainers. For more information on our trainers, you can read full bios at the CLUIN training page, and that link is at the bottom of this slide. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC Remediation Management at Complex Site team. That team was led by John Price at the Washington Department of Ecology and Carl Spring from the Colorado Department of Public Health. Our first trainer today is Carl Spring. He works for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment in Denver as a project manager overseeing environmental restoration at DOE's Rocky Flats site. Roy Thun is a senior environmental specialist with GHD in Santa Clara, California. His expertise includes developing integrated site strategies and closure options for complex sites. Chuck Newell is a vice president at GSI Environmental in Houston. His expertise includes site characterization, groundwater modeling, risk assessment, and long-term monitoring projects. Mike Trix is a senior project manager at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington. He works at the DOE Hanford site, providing technical and programmatic support for assessing and implementing improved remediation and characterization technologies. Sam Brock is a subject matter expert for toxicology for the Environmental Management Directorate Technical Support Division at the U.S. Army Civil Engineer Center in San Antonio, Texas. His responsibilities include resolving problems or issues impacting toxic and risk assessment. I'll now turn today's presentation over to Carl Spring at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Carl?
Thanks, Juliana. The challenge, meeting site objectives at complex sites. So what is the challenge at complex sites? What was the purpose in forming this team? As a profession, we have almost 40 years of experience with environmental remediation sites. But at some of these sites, complete remediation is still a significant challenge. We can usually take care of the immediate risk to human health and the environment, but it may be decades or even longer to reach regulatory standards. Each site is unique, and we may wonder if anyone has solved the specific problems that we face at our complex site. As a team, we came up with the following description of a complex site, and you can see this on your slide. Remediation progress is uncertain, and remediation may not achieve closure or even long-term management within a reasonable time frame. As you can see, reasonable time frame is a key concept in the definition. And of course, what's reasonable is site-specific and needs to be established among the regulators, liable parties, and stakeholders. And it's our goal in this training to introduce you to some of the concepts and tools in the guidance document to help you meet the challenges at complex sites. For instance, the guidance document has suggestions for determining what a reasonable time frame is, as well as a tool for assessing the remediation potential of a site. The document also provides guidance in applying what we call adaptive site management as a means of progressing the remediation process at complex sites. Now, there was a poll question that was presented when you were signing in, and it highlights some examples of challenges that we all face at complex sites. Looks like that most of you attending the training have been involved, have worked on a complex site, and it looks like there's some general agreement on what makes a site complex. Lots of votes for geologic conditions, hydrogeologic conditions, contaminant-related conditions, and those look like the leading candidates for what makes a site complex. Thanks, Juliana, for putting that poll up. We'll talk more about site challenges later in today's training. Now, here are a couple of examples of complex sites. You'll find many more in the case studies in the guidance document. The first photo in the upper left is an aerial view of the Rocky Flats site in Colorado. This is a site I've worked on now for over 25 years. This former DOE facility is about 10 square miles and was used for manufacturing parts for nuclear weapons. And the over $7 billion cleanup was completed in October 2005, and it was the largest environmental cleanup of a surface site at that time. Our case study features remediation efforts at one of the four groundwater plumes sourced from five solar evaporation ponds that used to store low-level radioactive waste and other wastes. The co-mingled uranium and nitrate plume covers 50 acres. The second photo shows investigation work in a residential area affected by vapor intrusion and groundwater contamination, downgradient of the Moffett Field, Middlefield, Ellis, Wisman, or the MEW site in California. The site is complex because of multiple source areas, multiple responsible parties addressing commingled plumes, multiple aquifers, there's eight zones in the aquifer, geologic heterogeneities, exposure pathways, and residential land use. Now, nationwide, there's a lot of interest in complex sites, but little guidance for tackling these challenges. A National Research Council report in 2013 initially sparked our interest in forming an ITRC team on this topic. The NRC report estimated that approximately 10% of environmental cleanup sites are complex, with a total cost to complete estimate of $127 billion. Now, a couple years later, the Hanford site in Washington, their budget was released, and it was $113 billion. And that suggests to me that the NRC report estimate is probably quite low. The NRC committee recognized the issue of complex sites, but noted that, and I quote, reaching agreement on which sites should be included in this category and what should be done with such sites has proven to be difficult. So there's clear need for additional guidance. Here's what you'll find from in our guidance document. We developed this guidance for state regulators, site owners, their representatives, and other stakeholders working at complex sites. Our team was large and diverse. We had almost 200 members with representatives from a variety of different groups. And as I mentioned before, this guidance represents a recommended process for remediation management at complex sites that we termed adaptive site management. This guidance incorporates and refers to best management practices and existing tools and technologies described in previous publications by the US EPA, other guidance documents by ITRC, by the Department of Defense, and others. We've included 16 case studies where regulatory decisions have been made, but for most of these case studies, it'll take decades to establish whether site objectives have been met. Stakeholder perspectives at complex sites are also summarized. Now, we suggest that one thing you can do at your own complex site is to ask different parties what is their definition of success for a site. And you'll likely hear different answers from the site owner, from the consultants, from the regulators, and from the community interest groups. Now, a full-page version of this flowchart that you see here was included in the document excerpts that was provided with registration information, and it's under additional resources. This slide follows the organization of the guidance, and it serves as a roadmap for today's training. Following this introduction, we'll talk about site challenges. That's the content from Chapter 2 of the guidance. We'll talk about remediation potential assessment, a tool that's covered in Chapter 3. Adaptive remediation selection, that's from Chapter 4, and long-term management from Chapter 5 in the guidance. We'll highlight case studies and stakeholder engagement throughout the training, and that's summarized in Chapters 6 and 7 of the guidance. This flowchart shows the adaptive site management process and the color coding to correspond with each chapter where the steps are discussed in detail. Now, adaptive site management is a complex, it's flexible, and iterative process that is well-suited for complex sites where there's significant uncertainty in remedy performance predictions. Adaptive site management involves periodically evaluating and adjusting the remedial approach against what we call interim objectives. It may involve multiple technologies at any one time and changes in technology over time. Now, what benefits can we expect by applying adaptive site management? Well, first of all, it does not offer shortcuts or the means to avoid site remediation. We'll continue to maintain protection of human health and the environment and take care of all the regulatory requirements, that is, the applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARRs. Now, adaptive site management, we feel, can improve site decisions and streamline decision-making, decreasing remediation costs, and potentially reducing remediation timeframes. It can also help establish milestones to demonstrate interim progress that eventually leads to the long-term goal. It reduces potential technical, regulatory, and procedural barriers to using various remediation management approaches that exist but are infrequently practiced. And it encourages returning all or part of the site to beneficial reuse early in the remediation lifecycle as remediation milestones are reached, at the same time recognizing that additional time may be needed to achieve the overall site objectives. Now let's quickly look at a case study. One reason we included the Naval Air Station Jacksonville in Florida was that site's adaptive site management approach to remediation. There was significant soil and groundwater contamination, including several chlorinated solvent plumes here. After some optimization studies, a five-year review identified several conceptual site model gaps. And so those optimization studies and the five-year review facilitated discontinuing interim remedial actions and conducting additional site characterization to reduce the remaining site risk. So the site then moved to a risk-based remediation approach and a new conceptual site model, all supported by technical demonstrations. As I said, we throughout the document have some tips on engaging stakeholders. The adaptive site management includes stakeholder involvement throughout the process, not just one meeting or one comment period, but throughout the process. Stakeholders, we feel, include all groups and individuals potentially impacted by the project. At complex sites, there may be multiple stakeholder groups and likely a long history to take into account, and that's exactly the case at the complex site that I've been involved with. Chapter 7 provides stakeholder perspectives and concerns at complex sites, as well as best practices to help stakeholders engage with owners and regulators. Now, it's really important, bottom line, really important to involve stakeholders early to build trust and to foster respect and improve quality of decisions. The case studies of complex sites indicate that effective stakeholder engagement reduces the cost of remediation and long-term management. Now, here let me add a quote from what our stakeholders said about from their perspective in engaging at complex sites. They said that frequently stakeholders enter the remediation process with different goals or priorities than responsible parties or regulators. Stakeholder groups may have competing interests or perspectives among themselves. Experience across the United States has shown, however, that robust stakeholder involvement can enhance community acceptance by modifying plans and activities and by informing stakeholders about the existing program. When all parties are informed, remediation often progresses faster and more efficiently, close quote. Now, one of the unique aspects of ITRC is that we include community stakeholders on the teams that develop guidance. Our team had multiple stakeholder representatives for this guidance because of the high degree of interest at complex sites. Stakeholders contributed to several of our case studies, which is reflected in those case studies' description of community involvement. This was a case study that was nominated by the stakeholders. The stakeholders at the MEW site influenced changes to characterization and to the selected remedy. They essentially became part of the remedy because they recommended local zoning and permitting requirements that address vapor intrusion problems at this site. This case study is an example of how remediation process and outcomes can improve because of stakeholder involvement. So by the end of this training, we hope that you will be able to, first of all, identify and integrate technical and non-technical site challenges into a holistic approach to remediation. We hope you can use the what we call the remediation potential assessment tool to identify whether adaptive site management is warranted due to site complexity. And we hope you can understand and apply adaptive site management principles. We hope you can then develop a long-term performance-based action plan and be able to apply well-demonstrated techniques for effective stakeholder engagement. We hope also that you can access additional resources and tools and case studies that are most relevant for complex sites. And then finally, be able to communicate the value of guidance to regulators, practitioners, community members, and others. So here's a roadmap of today's training. That concludes the introduction to the training, and in the remaining sections of the training, we'll be discussing, first of all, site challenges, both technical and non-technical. We'll introduce a remediation potential assessment tool. We'll talk about adaptive remedy selection and long-term management, and then we'll try to prepare you to take action. We'll include a couple of question and answer sessions, one in the middle of the sessions and then one at the very end. The next segment of the training will be presented by Roy Thun with GHD in California. Roy?
Thanks, Carl, and welcome, everybody. As Carl noted, I'll be talking about Chapter 2 of the guidance. This is the site challenges. This is what we're going to be talking about specifically, is the identifying those technical and the non-technical challenges. And these are the challenges that really help to inform your conceptual site model. The challenges, quite honestly, that determine whether a site really is complex, and we'll talk about that a bit more. I'm hoping through this part of the presentation that I'll be able to help improve your awareness of these types of challenges and the things that could impede the path to progress of your site. So later on, we're going to learn about how to quantify these challenges and how you create that holistic adaptive site management plan. So let's go on to one discussion about, you know, what a complex site is. Now here we have the Tri-State Mining District site. It covers 2,500 square miles, has widespread contaminated soil and groundwater and surface water as well. Now, when you look at a site like this, would you consider that to be complex? Would this be a complex site in your mind? I think most of you probably could say yes, and I wouldn't disagree with that. But I think what you'll learn through this part of the presentation is that the size of a site is just one factor that can contribute to, to its complexity. You're going to learn about many others that can contribute to it as well. So let's move on to the next slide. So Carl had mentioned the description of a complex site earlier in his opening statements. And just give a little background on the team. You know, as Carl had noted, this was a very diverse team. A lot of different backgrounds came to the table for this guidance. We had spent weeks debating the definition of a complex site. And what we all recognized is that remediation is inherently difficult, even at, you know, simple sites. And when we came up with this definition, you know, a complex site are where remediation progress is uncertain. And remediation is not anticipated to achieve closure or even long-term management within a reasonable time frame. And Carl had given emphasis on reasonable time frame because that is somewhat of a nexus issue for complex sites in determining whether or not you can achieve those remedial action goals within a reasonable time frame. But we want to make sure everybody recognizes that, you know, complex site is just words. What I would like you to take away from at least this part of the presentation is that it's that technical and those non-technical challenges that can impede remediation that we want you to be helped you to identify and recognize and include into your conceptual site model. And it's when we can identify these challenges that we really can improve your CSM and also maximize that remedial effectiveness. But enough with that little bit of background. We want to know from you all, you know, what you think the relationship is between a time frame, remediation time frame, and a complex site. So we have a question for you if you take a look at your screens here. And the question is, you know, which remediation time frame usually makes for a complex site? And you have the options of greater than 10 years, greater than 30 years, greater than 60 years, greater than 100 years, or time frame does not determine site complexity. So I'll give you an opportunity to think about that and choose what you think the relationship is between the remediation time frame and the complex site. Okay, some responses are coming in now. And it looks like about 45, 46% are indicating time frame does not determine a site complexity. But we also have another almost 40%, 38%, that believes 30 years is probably a pretty good measure as to whether you have a complex site. So it's an interesting question. Juliana, you can go ahead and take down the poll. We actually asked the same question of the state regulatory agencies, and here's what we came up with. What we found was that there wasn't any consensus. So similar to you, interestingly enough, remember you all had about almost exactly the same, about 47%. Well, the state regulators had the same. You know, they felt that there really wasn't remedial time frame wasn't the determining factor for site complexity. But we didn't have consensus. And what we recognize is that when it comes to remedial time frame and its relationship to a site's complexity, and perhaps even the reasonableness of that time frame, it's really in the eye of the beholder. Carl had mentioned that, you know, regulations, whether federal or state, don't really give much guidance as to how you define what reasonable time frame really means. And so that's really what we recognize as to be an issue that we're trying to help understand. And in fact, what we believe is it, when you have a time frame that's based on having site objectives that are considered both the technical and non-technical challenges, then you can develop what we would consider a reasonable time frame, because it does take into account the factors that would have the most influence on the remediation. So knowing that, we'll go on and we'll talk about these challenges that can increase the remedial time frame. We have two broad categories, non-technical and technical, that the guidance goes into depth on. On the technical side, you see there's geologic, hydrogeologic, geochemical, contaminant-related, and large scale. And on the non-technical side, you'll see a list of site objectives and changes over long time frames, regulatory changes, or even cooperation between agencies, the use of institutional controls or land use changes, and funding can be a substantial non-technical issue to overcome at any site. So looking first at the technical challenges, here we have the geologic conditions as a category or an area within the technical category. And we have things like geologic heterogeneity and preferential flow paths, fractured bedrock, karst bedrock, and low permeability media. These are all things that we have all seen at various times in our careers, or if you're fortunate enough to have a long career, you probably will see over your career depending on where you work. And on the right side of your screen, you see an example, a picture of these clay units. And you have they're dipping from your upper left to your lower right. And this is an example of stratigraphic heterogeneity that can take place. But imagine if you were doing your site investigation or installing monitoring wells and not knowing that this heterogeneity existed. Well, how could that influence your understanding of the site? Well, what you would find out with this overlap now, of these wells, is that if you didn't know this was existing, you would think that the information you're getting from the wells was representative of your plume dynamics, the fleet and transport. But if you did know this existed, then you would recognize quickly that you're actually not seeing the same water, the same geologic information each particular well. And this is really important. And as a geologist, I'll stress, because I believe it's true, that understanding the geology is absolutely critical to any conceptual site model and honestly to just about every remedial program that you have to deal with, perhaps with the exception of those that are purely surface water. But again, I'm biased, so I'll go on from there. Another type of technical challenge is hydrogeologic conditions. These are things like extreme or variable groundwater velocities, fluctuating water tables, areas where you have deep contamination, surface water and groundwater interactions and impacted sediment. The example you see on the right of your screen, that figure, that's one of the case studies that are in the guidance. So this is the Savannah River site in South Carolina. And this site was, one of the complexities of this site is that you had this groundwater plume that was occurring on the site, and I'll try and highlight that with my arrow here. So here in this kind of lightish peach color is the groundwater plume, and it was interacting with the sediments and ultimately getting into the Four Mile Branch tributary. Now, if you didn't understand that dynamic occurring, it could dramatically change your fate and transport modeling and understanding of the conceptual site model. And these are the types of things that draw that additional technical complexity to a site. And we have geochemical conditions. On this slide, we talk about things such as extreme geochemistry. Now, I won't go through all of them, but alkalinity is an example. pH, alkalinity has that ability to attenuate or neutralize acids, right? So it's a big factor in terms of how you would approach your remedial decisions for a site. Here you also have extreme groundwater temperatures, geothermal sources, or low temperatures such as permafrost. In areas where you have dramatic changes or fluctuations in groundwater temperature, that influences the sorption or desorption of contaminants, and that can be an additional factor. The picture is of the North Pole Refinery, and that's certainly a site that is subject to extreme temperatures. This gentleman here stepping out of his car, I don't envy him. I'm from Southern California, so coming out to that stark wintry vista every day would not be something I would relish. But the good news about these sites that are under geochemical conditions is that they tend to be remote. So at least from that perspective, there's often less likelihood of human exposure. But in other areas like use of energy, carbon footprint, and resources needed, are typically the cost and impacts are much higher for these types of sites. So moving on, we have other contaminant-related conditions. Now, things like these lighter, dense, non-aqueous phase liquids, LNAPLs and DNAPLs. Examples for the LNAPL, gasoline and crude oil that float on top of water. And the DNAPLs are the sinkers. So these are things like PCBs or chlorinated solvents that will gradually find their way to the bottom of your reservoir or your aquifer. We also have recalcitrant contaminants. These things like metals, for instance, is a common recalcitrant contaminant. High concentrations or multiple contaminants. And we can't forget about this last item, emerging contaminants. Changing emphasis over here to one of the items here, this per and poly fluoral alkyl substances, or PFAS. This is an emerging contaminant, not just here in the United States, but around the world. It is something that's been used in multiple industries for many decades, including firefighting foams and Teflon, and it is being found in more and more areas as an emerging contaminant, so there's many groups that are looking to try and understand this, and ITRC is one of them. They've developed several fact sheets on PFAS and are in the process of developing several more as part of an overall guidance on this emerging contaminant. And another area of reference for you is this ITRC in 2011 produced this integrated DNAPL site strategy document. And this is still used today quite widely as a primary reference document for understanding the dynamics of DNAPL, how these sinkers work in the environment and how you develop your approach, your technical approach for dealing with them. So we also can need to not forget these large-scale sites. Large-scale sites are interesting in that the location and the extent of contamination, the depth of contamination, number type and proximity of the receptors, and they usually having these extensive and often commingled plumes create a lot of problems, which drives complexity. Here, again, we're showing that Tri-State Mining District site, 2,500 square miles. It's impacting three different states and two EPA regions. So imagine trying to work through the cooperation of all these regulatory agencies that are involved and to come to agreement on decision processes. At sites of large scale, even things as such as routine maintenance of underground utilities become much more of a challenge when you potentially could be uncovering impacted soil or even shallow impacted groundwater. But we'll move on to another case study that's in the guidance. Now, in contrast to Tri-State Mining, here we have the UGI Columbia gas plant site in Pennsylvania. Now, this site's only 1.5 acres in size, but it sits about 400 feet away from the Susquehanna River. What you had here was 100 years of gas manufacturing, and you had overflows from a tar separator that entered the subsurface and got into the river, and eventually that residual tar got into the sediments, groundwater, and then deep into the fractured bedrock. We recognize that eventually that tar will slowly dissolve, but it dissolves over centuries. And really what we're trying to show with a case study like this is that even at small sites, you can have very difficult and technically challenging issues to contend with. So now that we've given you just a glimpse of the types of technical challenges, it's time to look at those non-technical challenges. And in the guidance, we try and give you an idea of the types of non-technical challenges that really can influence the decision process, the remedial decision process, as well as the remedial timeframes of a site. And these are the things like site objectives, you know, that could change over time. You have societal expectations and influence on the decision process. Interest in green and sustainable remediation and how to integrate that into your interim or overall site objectives. We also have things like managing changes over long time frames, and these are having a phased remediation approach or future use changes, maybe even site management changes that could occur. And we can't forget the regulatory side of the house, where things such as federal and state cooperation are of concern and need to be considered anytime that happens. Changing laws and regulations. And we have orphan sites. These are sites that are not funded. There could be a responsible party, but there may not be viable funds available to address those sites. Often we have also contaminants without regulatory guidance or criteria. We talked earlier about PFAS and how that's as an emerging contaminant. States and federal agencies both are trying to get a handle as to what the human health and ecological impacts are of this contaminant of concern and figure out whether or what regulatory guidance needs to be put in place for it. And we'll look next at things like institutional controls. You know, at sites, almost every site, you know, enforcing institutional controls can be tricky, you know, tracking and managing them, having the proper systems in place. And then when you extend that over a long time frame, you have additional challenges ahead of you. There's also land use questions, you know, changing land use or water use and having multiple owners or even site access. The picture at your right is actually from the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge. Now, certainly didn't start out that way. The Rocky Flats site was a major site that was being addressed for its contamination, and eventually large portions of the site were put into this wildlife refuge. And of course, again, we come back to this funding question. You know, lack of funds, political influence or program funding, but lack of funding is a really, I think, important one to highlight, because that's a problem not just for responsible parties, but also for the federal agencies and states. And many may not recognize that for Superfund sites in particular, that after 10 years, they will often go over to state for 100% funding. So states, too, recognize that funding is an issue, and you want to have a good enough understanding of your site conditions, these technical and non-technical challenges, to know not just how you're going to address the contamination, but also how you're going to fund it. And, of course, there's much more many more examples in the guidance through the case studies of these non-technical challenges. Here's another case study. This is the Velsicol site in Michigan. You know, the Velsicol site is an interesting site in that it was a case study that was written by the guidance stakeholders. So you get a very unique perspective, one that you may not often find in looking at certainly technical case studies. At the Velsicol site, you had 40 years of chemical plant operations. And it left you residual oil and fire retardants, pesticides like DDT, and even low-level radioactive waste. It had impacts to water supplies and livestock and residents' health, and, of course, the economic hardships that occurred as well. You had financially distressed responsible parties, which ultimately led to the residents forming their own community action group. In fact, one of the residents even wrote a book about their struggles. The interesting thing about Velsicol is that even though there was contaminants that were removed and the remedial systems put in place like pump and treat and slurry walls, and that the city water well supplies were replaced, the agencies involved and the residents, you know, still struggle to this day to define what success really means for this site. And that's a challenge, you know, and that's perhaps steps outside those bounds of the technical aspects of any site when you think about these other factors that influence people's lives in such dramatic fashions. And when you look at a site like Velsicol, you know, you wonder, you know, how would you address this site if you were a regulator? And just think about that. You know, from a technical, you have the technical challenges, certainly, but then you have all these other influences to think about as well. Well, that's just an example of how these technical challenges can extend beyond the technical aspects. These non-technical challenges can extend beyond the aspect of the normal technical issues that we contend with under traditional CSMs or conceptual site models. And this is why in the guidance, we recommend that folks consider a paradigm shift for their conceptual site models, one that can integrate these non-technical challenges as well as technical challenges. And we're going to look at the conceptual site model a little closer next. Now, CSMs, or conceptual site models, you know, they typically describe just the technical characteristics. But we do recommend that you balance that with non-technical challenges and accounting for it in the decision site documents, such as have been done in the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. And in California, you have the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. You know, both of these guidances and documents that are produced greatly take in a variety of non-technical issues and concerns from residents and affected communities. And we think that's a something that really should be considered as part of your conceptual site model. Now, this particular slide is representing US EPA's 2011 approach to developing a CSM, and it is a pretty good reference. EPA uses an approach that involves project milestones, and those are based on the knowledge and input of stakeholders, as well as continuously refining that conceptual site model based on the new data and information discovered. Ultimately, the goal is to develop a CSM with sufficient depth and clarity to accurately assess those risks and develop an appropriate remediation strategy. And we believe that the CSM should be a dynamic tool, and it should be updated for both these technical and non-technical considerations throughout the site's life cycle. So before I leave you, I want to share the lessons learned from our guidance. First, recognize that complex sites typically have multiple challenges. And it's both these technical and non-technical challenges that can impede remediation. You know, identifying them can improve the conceptual site model and maximize the remedial effectiveness. And perhaps more importantly, is it can help establish site objectives that can be achieved within a reasonable time frame. As an overarching consideration, and one that Carl had mentioned and emphasized as well, is that we really do encourage seeking early stakeholder engagement and building that consensus, especially around remedial time frame predictions. You know, when you do that, you can greatly reduce the complications that often arise from these non-technical challenges. And in fact, I think as a general observation, what we see is the more technically complex a site is, the longer the site typically will go in terms of meeting its remedial action objectives. And by doing that, what you see is a highlight of the number of non-technical issues and challenges that come forth. So they're kind of interrelated. The more technically complex, the more non-technical challenges that you can expect to arise as well. So with that, it's time to learn how to quantify all this information, and I'm going to turn it over to my friend, Dr. Charles Newell with GSI Environmental, and Charles will discuss the remediation potential assessment. Chuck, over to you.
Okay, Roy, well, thanks. Well, just to recap, Carl went in, and his message was sort of, why are we here? And then Roy did a great job in telling us that the world that we remediation professionals live in, it's a challenging world down there. So what is this remediation potential assessment? Well, it describes a process, and this process is based on 8 questions. And you go through this process, it asks you to answer these questions, and then it you have the option to process the data quantitatively. So that's really what we're going to talk about today is the 8 questions about remediation potential assessment. But first, let's go through the learning objectives, what we want you to get out of this. And so Roy just finished up with site challenges, and he talked about all the things, both technical, non-technical, that impact this. But now let's go to the sort of the salmon-colored box in the middle. And this, so what we're going to do here is use this remediation potential assessment to identify whether adaptive site management is warranted due to site challenges, okay? So this is sort of this question, do I use adaptive site management or not? And one thing that came up in some of our practice sessions, they said, hey, this isn't a line in the sand where it's just going to be vivid, hey, I'm not going to use it or I'm going to use it. There's a lot of gray zone in there, and there's a lot of perhaps non-complex sites that could really benefit from this adaptive site management that we're going to talk about later in the training in here. So that's the big picture. Off on the right, you can see, of course, we've got our flowchart. What's an ITRC document without a flowchart? So that's this process, and we're sort of, again, that salmon-colored diamond up in here that we're talking about. Okay, well, moving on, we're going to look at the sort of these different things, the process and the outcome. If you start there, and then the flowchart's on the right, you develop this conceptual site model, and then here's our question again. Is adaptive site management warranted due to site challenges? So the process is we have this screening tool, uses this weight of evidence approach to assess a site's likely to achieve remedial objectives. And one of the key benefits that we see in going through this process, you try to align expectations with actual remediation potential. And just some extremes, and maybe all of you have been in across the table or sitting in meetings with this, there's some different extremes, and there's one extreme that says, hey, we've got to get every molecule out of this site. It's a hazardous waste. Everything's got to go. And on the other extreme is, hey, we can't clean this site up at all. We can't do anything. Let's walk away. So it's trying to, part of this, going through this process can align expectations on what we can't do and what we can do to sort of make things better. We want to promote that it's effective and it's transparent interaction. And in the end, we're going to come up with this outcome that site objectives are attainable or that this remediation potential appears to be low. And that's when you really want to play this trump card, this adaptive site management out here to really make it work. Okay, well, let's go to talk about maybe using a very simple example to sort of set the stage in what we're talking about. So I'll go to the next slide, and here's a inspired by actually my brother-in-law who came in, and his father ran some convenience stores out in rural Tennessee, and he had some questions about gas spilling and potential releases. But in this hypothetical example here, this is not my brother-in-law's gas station in Tennessee, but somebody might say, I want to know, I have some interest in this particular location, and I want to know if I've got a big environmental problem or not. Well, you ask some questions, and you hear, hey, it's a small, shallow site, maybe it's a sandy, water-bearing unit. Hey, the concentrations are pretty low. There's some report that this person has. It's mostly benzene, that attenuates pretty fast. No indication of any much NAPL down in there. And so from this, you can sort of say from this first person, this friend who might ask you about this, hey, this looks like this is pretty more attainable. This is not one of these really complex sites that's out there. So that's the case of friend number one. Then you go to friend number two, and he's got some interest on this site. And then you start going through it, and there's a couple of reports. No, it's big. It's a mega site. It's very large. The contamination's deep. There's a lot of buildings under there that would be hard to get under. Sand silt fractured clays, it's got a lot of heterogeneity, there's not much biodegradation. You need over three orders of magnitude, three nines to get to your cleanup standards. And you start saying to friend two, whoa, this is going to be something you're going to live with some time. And so some of the lessons from this is, maybe you'll get a fruit basket from friend number one. And the second lesson is don't loan any money to friend number two. But I think that the idea from this example is all of us in this field have some key patterns or heuristics or rules about what makes a site difficult and what it didn't. And as part of this technical team we were on, we sort of condensed all these things and added ones and threw things out and tweaked them and ended up with these eight questions that really can help you define this remediation potential at your site. Okay, before we get to the eight questions, I'm trying to build up the anticipation here. A couple more slides. Let's talk about the purpose again. Tended to inform the remedial decision process and determine if adaptive site management is beneficial. We want to make sure it's transparent, facilitate future reviews of the whole process, and that it can be modified as appropriate. It's not this rigid thing, I got to do step A and B. It's this framework that you can use. And in some ways, it's like this biography, I guess, that Steve Jobs had read a long time ago. The journey is the reward, and maybe that's one of the themes that we have in here. Okay, let's do some disclosures here on the next slide. What does this thing do and what does it not do? Well, I'll start with some of the does's. Allows flexibility and site-specific input to an iterative process. Yep, you're going to take that site information to help answer these eight questions. Does it require detailed supporting data in extent? Yeah, you're going to have some information about your site to sort of figure out what's going on. And then does it consider remediation potential of individual factors in context of other factors? Yeah, you can weight some more heavily or whatever. But what doesn't it do? Well, it doesn't provide a means to avoid requirements. It's not one of these get-out-of-jail-free cards. It's not something really to evaluate if a site is complex. And this is the key nuance that we went back and forth. This is, are you at a site where this adaptive site management, which is the next sections that are going to be talked about, is that something that's really you think about applying at your site? It does not directly consider cost. Cost is in there indirectly, as you'll see in some of the questions, but it's not something like, oh, it's over X dollars, so we're going to do something else. And finally, it does not, in the end, produce a default decision on this thing. Okay, so that's sort of the run-up, and I'm just reminded of, I was at a wedding reception once, and I met a recruiter who hired maybe 10 people a week, and he was with Shell, and he said he could interview people and ask two questions, and they would respond, and he would have this insight into that person's soul and really understand what they were like and use that for his hiring. So this, in a small way, these eight questions are how you can look into the soul of your site and get some insights on how it might behave and can you get to the finish line, these remediation objectives. Okay, well, let's go to question number one. And so question number one looks something like this. It's going to go through and it's going to ask you, how difficult is it to work at the surface of a site? So what do we mean by that? Well, let's just say that you're at this sort of new site your company's working on, or that your company has some investment in there, and somebody says there's some contamination out there, but you get the call from Caitlin in the field, and she says, hey, this is going to be really easy to do stuff out here. It's a cow pasture. We just got to shoo these guys away, and then we can get our trucks out here. This is pretty easy to work on. Okay, so that's one extreme, but the other extreme, they call in, it's in the middle of this neighborhood, the clearance is out the kazoo. You know, it can't go in the living rooms, there are kids around, this is going to be more difficult. So there's this question that asks you high, medium, or low, what end of the spectrum are you in this question number one? How difficult at the surface? And the idea is, can you get your equipment out there to do injections, things of this nature? Let's go to question number two. And then, question number two, how difficult is it to drill at the site? This is a contact sport remediation where we're trying to get these reagents, these amendments in there. How easy is it to do? And if you get the call back, hey, this site, we can actually trench this stuff. We can get in there. And we can. It's a pretty, very shallow. It's the stuff. That's going to be easier. But on the other hand, if somebody shoots you a picture like this and they say, wow, it's inside this mountain and we got to get our rigs up there and it's got to be air rotary, it's remote. So this becomes sort of a different experience in terms of just the difficulty in drilling. So that's question two. Again, we're going to ask you low, medium, or high on how difficult it is. And we give some guidances, some thoughts about how you would classify a particular site. Is it low, medium, or high in terms of these questions? How difficult to work at the surface? How difficult to drill the site? Okay, so that's the first two questions. So let's keep going. Number three is all about the scale of the source zone or the plume itself, just how big of an area you're looking at. And so there's just this idea that I'm just going to do sort of geographically. You see the green dot here. Let's just say that's a factor of one. And then over here, this yellow box is 100 times greater. And if you go over here, this is basically a million times greater than the green box. Is that just the sheer cubic yards or the sheer hectares of material that affect your area, your plume size or your source? That's going to be a key controlling factor. I think one good statistic is we looked at 235 sites, and the average one was something about we're looking at 235 sites here. The average remediation volume was something around 5,000 cubic yards. And so this is one scale that we talk about that you can use to sort of see how this works. Okay, let's go to the next question. And it's what contaminant concentration reduction do you need? Is it 90%? You know, this is one order of magnitude. And so this is something that a lot of in-situ remediation technologies can do. This is in terms of some of the plumathon studies or source remediation studies show. But then if you start getting into this range, two nines, three nines, you know, four nines, it gets much more difficult to sort of get to that point and to get to the end game here in terms of you've just got a long way to go. And the key thought that this is an order of magnitude world we live in. We talk about hydraulic conductivity in unit towers of 10, and we draw our plume maps in power of 10, So just how many powers of 10 concentration reduction we'd need, that's one of these questions. Next is, let's talk about, do the key site constituents readily attenuate relative to the travel time of the receptors? Okay, do you have stuff that will attenuate? Does MNA work in here? Will that help you out? And so let's start out with one molecule, one of my personal favorites, of course. See if anybody knows what this is. It's toluene, right? And this is one that just degrades anaerobically, aerobically. At this Bemidji site where the USGS and University of British Columbia have been studying this crude oil spill for 40 years, this is the first chemical that went away entirely, 99% removal over that period of time. Now, on the other hand, if you've got chemicals like this down below, that's PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. That's a tougher road. That's typical. They just degrade a lot. It's much more recalcitrant we're talking about. So this is the question seven is sort of how does this attenuation factor sort of help you? Next, does difficult to remove mass exist at the site? And so, again, it's these two extremes. Somebody calls back and say, it's a sandbox. It's just all the sand. I don't see any sort of stratigraphy in this beach sand core down in here. Oh, okay, that's going to be easier to do than if somebody says down below, it's really heterogeneous. I've got a lot of clays and silt and sands down in here. Just to note, this is a really neat movie that the land donor, Tom Sale at Colorado State, did. Send me an email. I can send you the video link on this thing. But it's a three-minute movie about a lab experiment they did over a couple of months where they put a dye into this tank. And you see these four clay layers in there. They let the dye soak in for 26 days, and then they let the water flow by. And you can see this is matrix diffusion in the flesh that we're looking at right in here. So that's a key distinction between these two different questions in there. Next, we'll just first do a case study. This is something that the team came up with. It's a site diffusion plant in Kentucky for the Department of Energy. Let's just talk a little bit about some of the different ones, site access that we're looking at right in here. So site access first is, it looks like that there's surface access. It's not too bad. There's a couple of buildings, but maybe not too bad.
Drilling difficulty?
Well, it's a little deep. We're going down to, 60 feet, maybe a little bit farther. Maybe direct push can get down in there, sort of pushing the edge of that. So that's maybe a little tougher. What volumes are we talking about? We're talking somewhere about 10,000 cubic yards for a source zone, so that's bigger than average, but maybe not a sort of a super mega site in here. We've got different concentrations that we're looking at. These concentrations are about three or four orders of magnitude, pretty high still that are in there. Seepage velocity is pretty high, so the attenuation might be a little slower than other sites. And then I think number six, there's a lot of difficult to remove mass that's in there. So in terms of thinking of these questions and sort of putting in perspective, that's the type of things you ask, and each question you try to put into a low, medium, or high bucket. Okay, so next we're going to go and finish up with our questions here, and we've got question number seven, what is the predicted performance of available technologies? And it just says go to a lot of these databases that talk about there's a couple of these, and here's some examples of this is what you can expect from in-situ remediation performance. Now, most of these have been for chlorinated solvents, but the results, I think, are generally applicable to other technologies in some cases. But here's this integrated DNFL site strategy. I was on this team and helped put some of that data in there. Here's a great paper, Hans Stroh and other people from ESTCP 2012 that's got some data on it. And then a more recent one, 2015, my colleague Travis McGuire put together. You can get this from ESTCP, and it says there's 235 sites, and Travis tells you what the concentrations were before at these chlorinated solvent sites and after they did in-situ remediation. You can see what orders of magnitude they came up with. Okay, 7 out of 8. I've got one more to go, I guess. Let's do that one. And the last one is about remediation time frame. And so there are different ways of doing this. So here's an example from a site. This is from a National Research Council book, 2013, their alternatives book. But it shows on the y-axis aqueous concentration in terms of the starting concentration in percent. So that's how much it might go down over time. And, of course, the x-axis in years. Wow, the axis goes to 250 years. So thinking about Roy's question about different time frames in here, but they say there are different outcomes depending on some of these unknowns. If there's biodegradation that's occurring, here in the in the actual fracture in the whole matrix, then your curve is down here and you get 50 years. But then if there's not much degradation, you have the long tail extends out and out a long time. So that's sort of a key question that you can use in terms of question number 8. Okay, well, let's keep going. And just a quick note is we're going to talk about how to process the information here. Oh, first, I forgot this one. There are different computer models and analysis techniques. The US EPA REMCLOR, REMFUEL models are real useful. There's a new REMCLOR matrix diffusion that will be out in a couple of months. Dr. Ron Falt at Clemson is putting that together. We're working on the interface, trying to get this thing out the door. It should be real useful for our business. The USGS natural simulation software is well done. The matrix fusion toolkit from ESTCP. And then you can always do concentration versus time rate calculations. So a series of ways to think about time frame and how it might affect you. So if we move on now, I'm going to talk about how to use this. And basically it says put your answers, each question's got a high, moderate, or low, into this matrix and take a look at it. You can weigh certain criteria more than the others. You assess the conclusion. And on this one, if you look at it, well, we did went through this, and access was good. Drilling was okay. We have 4 highs, and we've got 2 moderates and 2 lows. And at the end of the day, you'd go through here, and you'd say, yeah, we have a pretty good likelihood of achieving our remediation objectives. Well, I'm just going to give you another example in here. And let's look at this. How about access? We're going to go through this one. And you start looking at some of these guys, and let's see, I'm going back here. First, access might be moderate. Drilling feasibility, we're pretty good. It's a high chance that we can do this. Scale is moderate. Then we've got concentration reduction. We have a long way to go, so I'm going to put that in low likelihood, that contributing to the remediation, achieving these remediation objectives. Attenuation's moderate, difficult to remove mass, a lot of clay, a lot of silt, a lot of matrix diffusion. Technology performance, we're thinking we can't sort of, there are a lot of technologies to get as far as we need to go, and time frame looks pretty bad. So, and this is the optional part. We talk about you can sort of add up these numbers in a semi-quantitative fashion, 1 high, 3 moderate, 4 lows, and this one would say, this is a tougher site. I got to do this adaptive site management. That's what it's telling you to end up with. Okay, just a couple more slides to go. And first is I'm going to talk about that a lot of this was designed if you're starting out at a project. What if I'm sort of in the middle of some sort of mediation process? Well, it gives you some questions to talk about and sort of answer. How is your remedy? Is it being effectively operated and maintained? Is you getting the most out of it that you can? I really understand my conceptual model that Roy talked about. We really understand what's going on, and has anything changed our understanding? Are these concentration reductions occurring at a rate that we anticipated? Did the selective remedy adequately address all the contaminants and all these hydrogeologic conditions? And then finally, can interim or site objectives be met with technologies within a reasonable time frame? So this is something if you're in the race, if you're actually ongoing, there's a separate set of questions you might ask just to make sure that you take an account for that knowledge of running and operating that system. Last slide, I'm going to sum up here. Hey, this is a screening tool. It provides a valuable process, does not produce a default decision. You answer these 8 questions and use this weight of evidence approach to assess if the site is likely to achieve remediation objectives in a reasonable time frame. Allows flexibility and site-specific input. And finally, the goal is to determine, hey, my site objectives are likely attainable, or no, they're not. The remediation potential is low. Adaptive site management is going to be really, really important here. So that's all my section. I'm going to quickly just say that after we're going to have Mike Truex from the Pacific National, Northwest National Lab talk next. But first, we're going to do some questions and answers. So let's move on to that.
Thanks, Chuck. Everyone is welcome to use that Q&A in the lower right to send in questions. If you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute. At this point, you're welcome to jump in with a question. Before we get to those questions, I do want to remind you that we are looking for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback both to improve today's course, and also we're developing new courses. So let us know what worked, what didn't work. That way we can design courses that better meet your needs. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So after you attend the class, Complete the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system generates a certificate for you. And right now, that's the only way to get the certificate. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again. There's also a feature, once you submit, if you have more than one person at your location, there's a way to go back and have each person at your location submit feedback and get their own certificate if that's something you're interested in. And if you do leave before we wrap up, you can access that feedback form in the middle right in those related links. You select feedback, and then you look down a bit, select browse to. That's going to open that in a new window for you. We have a question that's come in. Has anyone heard of natural source zone depletion, NSZD, and implemented it for complex site?
Well, this is Chuck. I'll start out and just say, yeah, this is a technology that is really being applied heavily, sort of in a ramp-up curve almost, in petroleum sites, for hydrocarbon sites, and using different methods, carbon traps, using temperature, using different instruments used in the global warming field to measure this amount of biodegradation that's occurring in the subsurface. And it's really M&A, but M&A is mostly for plumes. This is really monitored natural attenuation for source zones. And yes, there are, just my experience is we're applying it at several complex hydrocarbon sites, large refinery sites, terminals, and things of that nature, and just to see what happens in terms of these units. And typically what comes out of this natural source zone depletion at these sites is it would say that for that question five, yeah, we got these hydrocarbons, is that the actual hydrocarbons themselves are biodegrading, the long-chained alkanes. And you're getting answers like, hey, at my site, I'm degrading this whole oil, this whole hydrocarbon LNAPL down there, you know, say 1,500 gallons per acre per year. So a lot of it going on right now on the hydrocarbon side, and then people are starting to think, hey, let's transfer some of this over to the chlorinated side, but it's a little more difficult.
This is Juliana. ITRC does have a document on natural source zone depletion. So from the ITRC website, itrcweb.org, if you look in the documents, under LNAPL is where we have that document available. And so that may be a resource that you want to look into. The next question I also had as well, what were the two questions the Shell recruiter asked?
Okay, so I was at this wedding reception with my buddy, and he said he had these two questions. He says, my buddy should have asked the wife this, you know, before. Anyway, so he said that he always asks these two questions, and we've actually done it at the GSI for some hiring. The first one, I think you've heard of, tell me something you failed at and why. And that's always get some good answers, you know, people trying to think of something that's hard for them. The second question was more compelling to me. Tell me something that you thought was unfair, either to yourself or to other people. And why was it unfair, and what do you think they should have done about it? So then I've been involved in the hiring process for a long time, and I get some great answers from this. And so it's something that's people really have to think about. You know, get a sense of their character. There was one answer. He said the person was applying for some sort of clerical job, says, well, I got fired in my last job for taking office supplies, and I thought that was really unfair. And so, anyway, that's enough of that.
Where can we find information on the matrix diffusion model that you mentioned in question 8 of the RPA?
So this is Chuck. You definitely can send me an email. In question 8, there's the matrix diffusion toolkit that's available now from the ESTCP webpage. And just Google, in quotes, matrix diffusion toolkit in ESTCP, and this, you can download this spreadsheet and you can use it. And then the REMCOR model is available now, and you can also just Google REMCOR, name REMCOR and EPA, and then you can download the current version from the US EPA website. It sort of has a term where you can model a little bit of matrix diffusion in the source zone, but this new model, which is going to come out, I think, in a couple of months, as soon as the interface gets finished, that's going to have matrix diffusion of the plume, and I think that's really going to be a game changer. So it just... you can send me an email later on, hey, is Dr. Falta's REMCOR MD model out yet? And I can give you updates.
And information on all of our trainers is available on that CLUIN training page. So the related links, the third one down. So you select the name and then look down a bit, select browse to. That's going to allow you to open that in a new window, and you can quickly get to the email addresses for all of our trainers. Would commingling of plumes from multiple sites at different stages of remediation be considered complex?
The
Roy, I'll step in on that. I think the general answer, not to be take it lightly, is it depends. What we're really trying to show through this guidance, and you'll hear more through Mike and Sam's discussions as well, is that it's the question as to whether or not an adaptive site management approach is fit for purpose for your site. And that's really determined upon those technical and non-technical challenges that you face. So the fact that you may have a commingled site at different stages is certainly challenging, but the question is, really becomes one of, but is it getting in the way of you creating site objectives that you can achieve in a reasonable time frame? And I think once you start to recognize that that is the bigger issue for you, then the use of a remediation potential assessment and determining whether or not an adaptive site management approach would be appropriate for you. So there's no question about it that commingled plumes are always challenging, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're automatically fall into a complex site category. So hopefully that answers your question.
Another question has come in. It strikes me that the presenters are equating technical and practicability with adaptive management. Shouldn't we really be framing adaptive management in terms of managing uncertainty as opposed to TI?
Well, this is Roy again, and I think if I understood the last part of that was technical and practicability was in there, and you'll hear Mike Truex talk about the options to it that are available as tools for utilizing adaptive site management. So I won't steal his thunder, but absolutely, I mean this issue really resonates around the uncertainty of the site. But that uncertainty is what we're trying to help everybody to understand. And to the extent that you can address it, makes it even more. Hold on. To the extent that you can address it, makes it even more of a viable approach for your site strategy, whether it's an adaptive site management approach or other. So it's not about whether or not your site should be considered for a TI waiver. It's much more about understanding that uncertainty, as you put it, by knowing those technical and non-technical challenges that you face and putting together site objectives that you can reasonably achieve. And hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. We do have a couple of questions. Trainers may answer those online, and a reminder for trainers to send back to the individual who asked the question. And we'll have more time, I hope, at the end to ask more questions out loud. So you're welcome to send in questions throughout the second half of the training as well. For now, we'll continue on with the next section of the training, and I'm going to turn it over to Mike Truex at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory.
Okay, well, thank you, Juliana. And yes, we're going to move on to the next section, which is talking about adaptive remedy selection. And so we've heard some really good information in the first presentations about those foundational elements of thinking about your site in terms of what challenges are there, and then, importantly, kind of relating those challenges to what kind of remediation potential you might have or what sort of things might make remediation difficult. And if under those circumstances, we might need an adaptive strategy. So now that we've kind of thought about that, we need a plan, right? And so that's what this is about, is developing that plan. And so hopefully through this section, we can convey some ideas about how you apply adaptive site management principles and the types of steps you take to develop that plan. And so kind of starting out, I'm going to have you look here at this flow chart on the right side of the slide, and you'll note the light blue boxes are the development of this plan, and there are a couple steps we're going to use for that. But before we go through those steps, I kind of want to note that this is really important in terms of a plan, because as you note in the steps that come later when you apply this plan, we're going to be wanting to measure the performance of remediation. We know we're going to maybe be applying different phases or multiple technologies, so we have to have a way to have a plan for how we're going to monitor this process and then have feedback. And so you'll note there's even feedback on a large scale as you get down to see whether or not you've been successful. You may come back to this part of the process again later. So that's important. And also, we need to think about this in sort of two different situations. Of course, you can do this at the onset of a remediation project, but many times if you have a site with complexities, you may have already started some remediation, and maybe that has not worked out, and that's why you're here. And so let's go to a poll question and just see how many of the participants today have had an experience where they've been at a complex site and started remediation, and there's been some problems with that, and so maybe you're going to have to come back and rethink things. And if so, the right-hand side of this poll question says, well, what kind of things did you think about? What were those sort of second-step items? What did you think about optimization or some sort of contingency, and did you do some more characterization, or maybe you did some technology testing or modified your site objectives? Those are all things that you might have thought about. And as I see the polls coming in here, it sounds like a lot of people have had this experience of having difficulties with a remediation project, and a pretty good spectrum of folks that looked at these different types of actions that can be taken. And all those are, of course, very valid, and I think where the ITRC guidance comes in is it says, okay, well, we know there are these things that we can do. We're going to kind of, in this adaptive site management, give you a structure to help you walk through that in as organized a fashion as possible, because that will help you down the road, because we might be in this for kind of the long term. So we'll go ahead and close the poll here and move on to sort of finishing this slide, and that is to say that there are steps with this planning that I'm going to talk through. We're going to talk about refining this conceptual site model. We're going to talk about those site objectives, those large-scale objectives, and then we're going to talk about kind of the details of the plan, which are those interim objectives and adaptive remedial strategies. So I'll kind of walk through those here next. And here we are talking about a conceptual site model again. And so when we get to this planning phase, it's important to relook at that conceptual site model and say, okay, now that I'm going to set out a plan for how to address these, have I really described those challenges adequately? And have I identified, if this is something that we've tried remediation at before, have I identified what has inhibited my remediation in those previous attempts? And then as you do that refinement, you have to say, now, are there any other data gaps that I have to, any information needs I have before I get into this planning process? So it's important to think about this when you're doing the planning, because now you got to put some things down on paper in terms of what you're going to do. And there are some good tools out there that we point to in the guidance. We've got an appendix with a bunch of tools that are listed. There's also other documents like the integrated DNAPL site characterization document. So there's some good ways that we can look at resources, and the particular complex site guidance gives you a lot of fingers out into those resources, because we know that those are going to be important. So we're going to revisit that conceptual site model, and part of it is kind of thinking traditionally about, okay, how do I go get more information about component X or Y, but it's also about really having an organized way to think about it in relation to the planning you have to do. And so here's an example of a case study site in Australia, and that site, they use this 20-compartment model. So here you'll see that they listed out the different phase of contaminants over here on the left-hand side, where they've talked about soil vapor, DNAPL, groundwater. They've listed across the different segments of their site, so they realize that things are different in different areas, the source, the proximal plume, the distal plume. And then they've added in this other piece where they're talking about permeability. Well, that, we know that relates to your remediation potential, the behavior of a contaminant. So they've broken that out, and then they've identified, where is my contaminant located? Where am I going to have to focus my efforts in order to reach my goals? And so this is an example of what we kind of mean by doing this type of articulation of the conception model that really supports your planning, because now I'm going to be devising my remedy strategy to address these sorts of areas where individually I have to look at contaminant in different types of compartments in this case. So now that, you know, we've kind of talked about this idea of making sure we have the conceptual model set, we're going to move to the next step, which is to set or revisit, if you've already have these set, the site objectives. Now, what are we talking about in terms of site objectives? These are your big target. This is your overall target, where we're talking about things like protective of public health and the environment. These are the ultimate goals that we want to establish for a site. So it's important to think about those And here's kind of related to the question we had. You know, you have to think about those in relation to the complexities at the site, and you may have to also think about them in terms of these different segments of a site. You know, your site may have different areas, the source, the proximal plume, and the distal plume, and there may have to be different objectives for those different areas. Now, this is something that all of the parties have to agree on, the regulators and the site owners, but it is something that's important to think about at these complex sites. And you may, of course, be revisiting these if you are coming to a site where you've already tried something and you have to say, well, that didn't work. Now what are some of those next steps? And I'm going to kind of walk through some of these steps that are related to the different regulatory programs. So I'm going to start with CERCLA. And, of course, CERCLA has the two threshold criteria of protecting human health and the environment and the applicable, relevant, or appropriate requirements. And, of course, those are out there, and we need to consider that. But there are also the possibilities of these error waivers when appropriate. So I'm going to open up another poll now and just see if the participants have had a situation where you've been at a site where you've had to evaluate the potential for using an error waiver. And if so, you know, how did you do that? Did you look at one of the classic CERCLA error waivers, or were there some other approach that was used that's not one of the specified waivers? And so actually we see that there's a majority that of those responding that have not applied those, although we have about 12% now that have, and they've looked at specific types of ARL waivers. And so this is an area where these may not have been applied in a lot of situations within our participants, but what we want to highlight in the guidance is not that we're advocating for waivers, but that we want to recognize that those are possibilities out there if your particular site characteristics are such that we need to think about that. So I'm going to have you close the poll now, Juliana, and we'll kind of go back and look at, under CERCLA, what are some of those options. So again, in the guidance, we wanted to talk about what's out there. So the ARL waivers under CERCLA, we have inconsistent application of state standards, fund balancing, equivalent performance. So these are types. Then you might think about others that maybe are more applicable to a complex site when you have a phased approach, and you might need to say, well, we need to do some interim measures, where you might have a greater risk issue, where you have some really problematic material and there's a greater risk with certain options over others. And then, of course, like we had in the question, there is the technical impracticability waiver. And so that's another type of approach. If it's appropriate to reset or think about a site objective that has some waiver to these overall objective. So let's look at what that means, though, and what we tried to do in the document, in the guidance document, was to give you some information about, well, how do you have to go about thinking and applying these if they are potentially appropriate. So here's a case study. It's at a wood treatment facility, a very difficult site, has a creosote and a pentachlorophenol D-napyl, very difficult contaminants. It's a drinking water aquifer. Now, the site went through actually a lot of work. They did a lot of characterization, and they did actually a lot of technology tests. And what they found was in this outer area of the site and along in the plume, they found, well, we have some approaches that we can use to reach our objectives in those areas. And so we're going to keep our regular site objectives and ARRs. But in this zone, in this source zone, this four-acre zone, there was not going to be something that they could apply where they could with certainty reach that their overall goals within a reasonable time frame. So there, the technical impracticability waiver set containment as the goal. So they're meeting some goals outside. Inside, they had this TI waiver. The steps to get there was that they had to do a lot of characterization and a lot of looking at technologies to justify that that was indeed the case. So again, in the document, we kind of walked through some of those examples. Under CERCLA, of course, there's also alternative concentration limits. So this is when you have groundwater that's in contact with surface water. So you have some discharges to surface water, and in those discharges, you can demonstrate that there's not a statistically significant increase in concentrations downstream. In other words, it's controlled, and there are factors that are attenuating that impact, and that there's not exposure directly to that contaminated groundwater prior to discharge. So this is a controlled setting. So this is another option, again, if that's appropriate for your given site and all parties agree. Now, in the document, we actually didn't identify any case studies, but it is actually on the books as another potential alternative to consider. So So those are the CERCLA programs. We also went through and looked at RCRA and other state programs. And here I think that the team took an interesting approach. We actually sent out a survey to states about their RCRA brownfields and underground storage tank programs. And we got a lot of responses. 40 states responded, so a pretty good response. And what we asked them is we lined out all the sort of options that there are for different types of objectives, and we asked the states, well, do you apply those as a primary means when you're setting site objectives, or do you potentially consider those after the original remedy fails and maybe you're revisiting what might be appropriate for an overall objective? And so in the document, of course, we give you a lot of information about how they responded. I'll give you some examples here, and what I want you to note here is that out of 40 states, here we have six examples where quite a few states, you know, we're talking 38 out of 40, 36 out of 40, quite a few of these states responded with that they do consider these options. So here you see risk-based criteria, institutional controls, designated points of compliance, alternative concentration limits like we just talked about, technical impracticability, and low-threat closure criteria. So the idea here, again, is not to advocate necessarily for these, but to let you know that these options are out there, and indeed states will consider these if the conditions are appropriate. So in the documents, you'll find a lot of information about that. So those are kind of our first couple steps. We talked about making sure you know what your site conceptual site model is and the challenges that you face. We talked about those overall objectives. What are we aiming at in the future? And now we're going to talk about how we're going to develop the plan. And there's two components to that. One is to set interim objectives, and one is to set that strategy. So you kind of think about this as I'm going to take a road trip across the country, and I have to pick some points along the way that are going to say I'm going to get this far by day one, and by day two, and by day three. Those are kind of your objectives, your steps along the way. And then I'm going to have my plan. What roads am I going to take? And so that's these kind of two components. And the interim objectives, when we talk about that, know, sort of steps along the way and how I'm going to judge that, that's a little bit different from those side objectives we just talked about. So let's pull up a poll here, and you can kind of think about this with a couple questions that kind of contrast these. So on the left, you have something that says restore groundwater to beneficial uses. Is that a side objective or an interim objective? And then on the right-hand side, if I have an objective to reduce mass flux off-site by 50% in 5 years, would you see that as a side objective or interim? And as you can see by the responses here, kind of lowball questions maybe. It looks like a lot of people are saying that, yeah, when I'm talking about restoring and beneficial uses, that's a long-term objective. That's a site objective. Now on the right-hand side, mass flux reduction by 50% in 5 years, that's a kind of step along the way. That's something I can measure really well, and I can say, yeah, I've gone that far in the first day of driving, right? I got that done. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm done forever. Not all the way across the country yet, but that's what we'd call an interim objective. So let's go ahead and close the poll, and we'll come back to the slide, and now we're going to kind of move on and talk about these two elements, these interim objectives and the strategy, and think about this strategy again. You know, is either that road trip, or maybe you got that apple, and you're not going to eat that apple in one bite. You're going to take bites of it. So let's figure out our strategy to eat that apple. So let's think about those interim objectives. And like I said, these are things that we're going to use to kind of judge what we're doing along the way and say that we've shown progress. And so we kind of borrowed from the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy document. They talked about this idea that if you're going to set those interim objectives, they should be specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound or SMART. And that means, look, these are things you're going to have to judge your performance by. You're going to have to communicate with all the interested parties. You need things that are really clear and specific, and that's what this SMART acronym helps you with. So things like contaminant mass flux reduction within by a certain percent within a number of years, I can measure that. Target reduction degradation rates are met within a certain number of years. That's something I can measure and have feedback on, or maybe it's an action. I'm going to cap a site, and I've done that. Now I can move on to my next step. And what those are important for is because those are going to help us with our short-term decisions and actions. So as we go along and we make these measurements, we might say, well, are we getting there, or do we need some optimization to reach that goal that I put out for myself? And then if I reach that goal, how does that inform me how I might go to my next step, you know, transition to my next technology? And so these are really important to guide our steps. And so we spend quite a bit of time in the document talking about how to set those. So now that I've got those set, I've got to say, well, now what's my plan? How am I going to reach those? And so, of course, we have to identify some options. And each site has differences in what they might need. So what we tried to do in the document is provide you information. So if you look out at sites like CLUIN and other sites, there are lots and lots of options. So you see here at the top of the slide all sorts of different categories of remediation options. And of course, we provide some pointers to those sorts of major sites where you can get information like CLUIN. But we also went through with this table on the bottom. We said, well, for these different types of options that we have listed here on the left-hand column, we also provided some additional pointers, some different types of references that might be important and specifically pertinent to a complex site. So again, sort of an informational section of the guidance document, but it's important to kind of gather all those options to say, hey, we've really looked out there to see if there's something that might help us in this difficult situation. So if I've got those all pulled together, then the next ideas is very similar to what you do at any site, and that is you're going to compare remedial approaches and decide, well, which one is best? Which one do I go with? And you're going to assemble your remedial alternatives, and there are regulatory processes to do that. And that is the way that you need to make your decision, because those are described in the regulations, and so you need to follow that either through RECA or CERCLA. And here you see on the right-hand side the CERCLA 9 criteria. Those are very useful in making that decision and requirements. In this guidance document, what we're going to do is kind of advocate for you to think about those additional considerations while you're doing that comparison that relate to site complexities, those things that are your challenges. So, for instance, how does each remedial approach address those complexities? That might be a question that you ask of each one that's a little bit different from those criteria you see over on the right-hand side. They're kind of underneath some of those, but it's an important aspect that you need to consider. So we're going to kind of walk through some additional considerations here. So what about the level of confidence in your ability to implement the remedy? Think of that in terms of those challenges that are out there. So one technology might be different than another. Do you have synergy with other technologies? We think that for these adaptive strategies and for these complex sites, we're going to be doing multiple things, not just one thing. So do they play well together? Are they adaptable over time? Well, adaptability is the name of the game for an adaptive site management strategy. Do they give you information when you apply the remedy to help you with your future decisions? Remediation is actually a way to get information about your site. It actually gives you characterization information, which technologies might do that better than others. And are they robust with respect to meeting your objectives and your ability to monitor them and demonstrate that you are making that progress? So important in here, as you'll notice, these are kind of flavors, right? And so a lot of times you think about this comparison of comparing apples to apples. That's really important. Well, at a complex site for an adaptive remediation strategy, actually, you may prefer oranges. Oranges may weigh more than apples at this site because they help you with the strategy or help you address those challenges. So that's important to consider in this process is that, yes, you need to use the framework, but we need to consider these additional items as we go through these. So as you go through this process, now you've kind of weighed some different options and you're looking at different technologies for the strategy. The other thing to think about is that, again, it may not be the whole site or the whole site may not have the same type of objectives. So you might have to prepare a matrix. And so here you see in this particular matrix where we've got site objectives on the left-hand column, and then you may have divided your site into segments. You may say, well, hey, the source is going to be a little bit different than the plume, and then I'm going to have maybe some different technologies in each of these boxes to address the objectives that I have. And I may have more than one technology in these boxes because, again, this is a complex site. So again, the document kind of gives you some tools to think about, well, how do I organize this process? Because it's not just going to be technology A versus B versus C. It's going to be technology suite A versus technology suite B versus technology suite C. So those are things that you need to keep a handle on. And so we'll give you a case study here to kind of think about. And this is at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal in Colorado. And one of their components of the remedy was to put on a cap. And so they put on a cap as part of that as to help prevent surface exposures and reduce infiltration, those sorts of things. But they developed this matrix because they had the situation where they had different objectives for these the different components, source removal and treatment, containment, protection of human health and ecology. They had an on-site and an off-site component. And then look what they've done here. You've got a lot of different technologies in each of these boxes, right? There's not just a one technology setting for many of these. And they're different between this box and this box because there are different settings. And so you've got to organize your approach to this in these ways. And that's important at these complex sites where you might do different things both spatially and, of course, temporally. You'll have to evolve this over time. And that's where we talk about these technology transitions. So this is a case study of how you might do that. And this whole sort of section where we talk about developing this plan and these different aspects of the plan and how you're going to evaluate different technology approaches and pick the one you think best are important to keep track of and actually are document. Because this is your plan. This is how you're going to go forward. And because it's the plan that might evolve, well, that will evolve over time, and you're going to be applying this performance metrics, you need to articulate that because you're going to be sitting down at the table over the next however many years with all the interested parties saying, how well are we performing? Is everything on track? Do we need to optimize? Do we need to move to the next step, right? So you need to document that. You need to make sure it clearly states your technologies and your interim objectives and then how you're going to be evaluating that over time. And, of course, you need to follow the regulatory guidance for documentation, but our goal is not to produce a set of binders that sits on a shelf, but it's to produce a plan that we're going to be looking at and actively engaging in over time. So that's a really important aspect that we try and emphasize in this ITRC guidance is those elements that we need to get on the table as we go through and manage this plan. And so we've talked a lot about that planning process and the types of things we have to do, and those are all actually excellent opportunities for stakeholder engagement. So you heard earlier in the training about stakeholder involvement, both in our team here at ITRC, but also in this overall process. And so for the stakeholders, when you think about this document and you think about, well, how does this relate to what we need? Well, this plan, this process is a way that it says, hey, these are points in this overall remediation where we can talk about our concerns and values as that plan is developing. We can think about ways, well, how are we going to manage how to make that happen? And so in the document, we talk about strategies like gathering and organizing information about the site and creating forums and getting in there and being involved with planning process and engaged in this. And that, as has been discussed earlier, we find is really important in terms of making sure that the plan is robust to meeting everybody's goals along the way and that everybody understands, well, how are we going to be managing this process? And, of course, for the responsible parties, again, this plan is sort of your centerpiece. It's your ability to communicate and talk about what you think are some of the best ways to approach this. You can seek out those community members. You've got these tools that we've talked about to help that facilitate that communication, and this whole process builds trust and ultimately helps you move that remediation effort forward towards reaching your ultimate goal. So the stakeholder element is important in ITRC documents, and we wanted to emphasize it here at this planning phase because that's kind of a central zone for that to happen. Now, obviously, as you go into our next stage, which where we'll talk about long-term monitoring and how you actually implement, that's where you know that will continue. But this is a key part where this sort of starts and is really a good engagement point. So in summary, here, you know, we emphasize some of the steps that you need in this planning process. We said, hey, you know, we've talked about the conceptual site model, but as you do this plan, let's refine that and really make sure it's addressing and articulating those challenges we're going to address with this plan. We're talking about setting or maybe revisiting those site objectives. And again, not advocating that that has to be done, but for these sites, if it is appropriate, there are some options out there, some flexibility. And in fact, we've highlighted that within the state programs, for instance, there are those options in setting objectives. And so if that's appropriate, you've got some information here in this document about how to go out looking for those. And then building this adaptive remedial strategy. So here again, we kind of talked about taking an approach where recognizing that you have to have multiple technology in different phases, both in time or maybe in space with segments, that you need to be organized, and you need to kind of think about technology selection in terms of how it fits into this adaptive strategy. And then when you build that strategy, it's going to be related to achieving those steps along the way to guide your progress. So that's what are your interim objectives and how are you going to measure for it? And then, of course, it's an adaptive strategy. You may need to be coming back to some of these elements that are in this chapter, because as you go along, if things aren't working out or you find out some new things, well, you may need to come back and revisit that. And, you know, that's okay. That's part of the adaptive process. So that's kind of a summary of the planning. And so basically we're ready to now move on and say, okay, now that I've done this plan, how am I going to implement this? What's my long-term management going to look like? And Sam Brock with the Department of Defense is going to lead us in that next section.
And Sam, you may need to unmute your phone, and if you use our system, it's #6. I think
thank you,
can
Mike.
Hear you now.
Okay, thank you. We're now at the long-term management section of the guidance, and Mike has done an elegant job of setting up the kinds of things that we need to consider to describe the technology we're going to use at the site, to determine what our long-term and interim objectives are going to be, and then to also caution us to think about how we're going to evaluate the performance. And as we look at the guidance document, our objective here is to develop a long-term and performance-based action plan. This is the script that we need to follow in order to skillfully execute the technologies and approaches that we've determined are the best way to approach remediation at a complex site and in the process to comply with regulations and achieve protectiveness. And as we refer back to the flowchart, we're going to talk about the three action steps of developing the management plan, of designing and implementing the remedy where we actually install the relevant technologies, and then designing the monitoring and evaluation processes where we're going to generate the data necessary to actually evaluate the performance of the approach that we have selected. And we'll talk in a few minutes about the decision diamonds that you see on the diagram. We'll get into those a little further. You'll notice the green circle at the bottom. The expectation eventually is to complete the process and close the site. However, in complex sites, we put this circle in there for completeness. Our energies for quite some time will be focused on the steps in the higher up on the chart. As we go to slide 80, in terms of developing the plan, we want to keep in mind that the plan needs to be flexible. We're going to learn as we go. We're going to determine more clearly what the specific decisions or requirements to support the decision makers are. And we also want to provide a documented completion strategy. We expect we'll be at these sites for decades, and so it's necessary that we keep track of what we're going to do and also keep track of any changes in that course that we may determine are necessary. We need to document remedy expectations, what change is expected, how fast is that going to occur so we can plot progress. We need to do remedy evaluations on a schedule basis, and we need to reevaluate those remedies when site circumstances dictate that perhaps our performance is lagging. And we want to make these decisions in a timely manner. The components of the long-term management plan are many of the things that we've talked about previously. We've got to have a strategy, what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, where we're going to do it, how long is it going to take. We need to describe the remedy, the technology or combination of technologies or sequence of technologies that the evaluation has determined is appropriate. We need a performance model that we're going to use to predict what the performance over time should look like. The importance of that will be emphasized in a minute. We need a timeline, and we need criteria. We need
schedules for when we're going to monitor, what we're going to monitor for, when we're going to evaluate performance, and how we're going to make decisions about whether that performance is acceptable or needs revision. We want a decision logic. If we have sequential technologies where we plan to change remedial technologies at various points during the life cycle of the site, we need to spell out the decision logic for what conditions are necessary to go to the next step and for determining when it's time to take that action. Project risk and uncertainty. We talked about uncertainty in the Q&A session, and if you talk about the complexities that Mike and Chuck talked about earlier, those complexities represent categories of risk or uncertainty in terms of how well is our technical approach going to perform. And it's appropriate to look at those uncertainties in terms of what monitoring, what contingency action, what management decisions might be required to respond in the event some event that we weren't particularly expecting occurred. In terms of the completion strategy, we need to keep in mind that it's probably going to be iterative for complex sites. Collaboration is also going to be indicated in all cases, collaboration between stakeholders, between responsible parties, regulators, technical consultants, in order to bring together the variety of technical skills and evaluations that are necessary at these sites. We need to consider how to maximize future land use, and of course we have to consult the relevant guidance. And to that end, I would commend your attention to the technical guidance. The bibliography is a good list of pertinent references, and as you go through the text, it will cite publications by ITRC, EPA, and others that add substantial depth to the evaluations that we're doing. With regards to addressing and assessing project risk and uncertainty, we want to identify those key elements of activity that represent the risk, and we want to identify the actions that could reduce that risk or put us in position to have contingency plans in place in the event those events occur. We would call out the ITRC risk management for site remediation guidance. There are tools and checklists and more in-depth discussion of those activities. And as we're looking at risk, we really want to look at not only the performance of technology, but what are the uncertainties in any engineering assumptions we've made, assumptions about stratigraphy or site characterization, or uncertainties that are inherent in the tools that we use to build our models. As Mike pointed out, we want to describe the selected remedy, and we want to be very systematic about that in terms of describing each component of the remedy and make a description for each component for each segment of the site. It may be source area and dissolved phase plume, or there may be more segments depending on site conditions. We want to be clear about the interim objectives and what performance metrics are going to be used to track progress about whether we're meeting these metrics or not. And we may need to set them as a consequence of our long-term management phase. Now, as we learn more about the site through working there, we will find that we probably need to modify our timelines and our phase points based on actual site conditions. It's important to have an understanding of the time frame that we're looking at on the site for a particular objective, as well as the timeline that we have to think about in terms of the site objective. And keep in mind, if we're dealing with a 100-year site, we're probably going to have different contractors, different professional staff, different regulators that are going to come and go, and for this, for cleanup to be effective, we're going to have to stay on the plan. And the plan's going to have to consider maintenance and monitoring as well as the technical evaluations. Now, as an example of how we would describe our remedy, we would have a description for remediation, the remediation component, perhaps an order of magnitude reduction in contaminants. If it's to control migration, we would have metrics that deal with mass flux, say an 80% reduction, or how we're going to measure plume capture if we're dealing with an engineered system to prevent migration, as well as engineered controls and institutional controls as interim measures to prevent exposure while we're implementing the remedy. The performance model is an expression of the expected change in concentration over time. And we want to show that decay curve in relationship to an interim objective. And this is the model of what we expect to occur. You'll see this curve again in a couple of slides, and we'll talk some more about it. But as we talk about monitoring and performance evaluation, we want to set up a schedule to do the monitoring, to include the monitoring attributes in the plan, what contaminants, what location, or what other physical measurements have to be made. We want to evaluate the plume, the contamination cleanup, and we want to evaluate any remedial, any engineered systems that are part of that process. And then we want to schedule the performance evaluation, typically perhaps within a five-year review at a CERCLA site or some other relevant period that allows time to evaluate changes at the site. We want to align our monitoring with the performance objectives so that we can make the decisions about remedy performance. And then we'll look at whether the progress is adequate and what responses may need to follow that. And as you see, as we come down after the evaluation, is the interim objective met? And if not, then we have to make a series of decisions about, is progress acceptable? If not, can we optimize it? If it takes more than optimization, do we have a contingency planning? And if we don't have a contingency plan, then as Mike pointed out earlier, we go back to the procedures in step four, where we reevaluate the site and reevaluate technologies with the goal of getting our performance back on track. And we want to monitor our performance by graphing, by comparing actual performance to expected. In the green line, this is the performance model. And any level of performance below this line is good. And this is what the performance model a couple of slides ago looks like. As we look at the black dashed line, that's where we're tracking the actual decline of, in this case, mass of contaminant from soil vapor extraction. As that declines over time, it goes from the green into yellow, starting to flatten out at that point. We go back to our decision diamonds. Well, can we optimize that or enhance it? In this scenario, we added a thermal enhancement to the soil vapor extraction. Heat improved the recovery, as we see in the green dashed line. But after a period of a few months, we see that that green line tapers off again. And we notice that that green line tapers off at a level, becomes asymptotic above our interim objective that we've specified for the site. And at that point, we're going to have to consider, is that good enough? What else can we do? Or is it time to consider another increment of our remedial approach? Do we transition to natural attenuation? Is there some other technology that we need to consider? As we look at what goes into that performance evaluation, and we've covered some of these in the discussion of the slide, but we want to look at the site. Do we understand the nature and extent of the contaminant, the properties of the contaminant? Have we evaluated mass adequately? Do we understand plume dynamics? Is it increasing or shrinking? Is attenuation occurring? Is that decay on track to meet the remedial objectives or the interim objective? And also, is our technology performing according to the design spec? And is that design performance adequate to achieve the remedial objectives that we expected from it? So now that brings us to our decision logic, and there's some potential outcomes that can follow from a performance evaluation. The remedy could be complete if we've met our site objective. We would at least hope that our remedy is on track. We're not at the interim objective, but we're making good progress. Things appear to be working. The remedy appears reasonable, and we need to just keep doing what we're doing. Or if we find that our performance is flagging and not meeting our objective, then we may actually need to revise the remedial approach. And there's a continuum there. We can look at optimization. We can look at contingency remedies that we may have on the shelf for the site, or we can go back and do supplemental investigations, supplemental technology evaluations with the objective of getting our site into the most protective condition that we can achieve. And the idea here is to either achieve the objective or understand why an alternative objective is appropriate for the site. To illustrate this a little bit further, we'll talk about a site in Colorado. We had two recalcitrant contaminants in bedrock. We were able to implement enhanced in situ bioremediation for TCE. However, that reached asymptotic concentrations and ceased to progress above the promulgated cleanup standard. The other constituent, NDMA, we had no effective in situ technology. Site conditions and low yield formations limited the effectiveness of pump and treat, and so we implemented natural attenuation with institutional controls. And I would add that the MNA was supplemented by a negotiated environmental covenant that allowed us to implement the use restrictions necessary and involved purchasing some water rights leading up to the negotiation of the covenant. So we've talked about the importance and value of the plan components, how that plan supports the monitoring and natural and the evaluation of remedial performance at the site. And then we've illustrated the importance of following our decision logic so that we can make timely and appropriate management decisions. And at this point, I'd like to turn it back over to Carl, who will discuss the next steps here.
Hi. Thanks, Sam. That concludes our training on remediation management of complex sites. In the training sections, we covered how to, first of all, recognize the technical and non-technical challenges at your site, how to use the remediation potential assessment as a decision-making tool, how to make use of the adaptive remedy selection process, and then finally how to take your site into long-term management. Now we want to prepare you to take action, to make a difference at your sites. This training has highlighted elements in our guidance document. We hope this taste will lead you to become familiar with this guidance and then to encourage its use among the site owners, among responsible parties, among regulators, among stakeholders. So to help us understand the potential of adaptive site management, let's take a final poll. And the choices here are simple. The poll is, would you recommend using adaptive site management as we've described today at your sites? Now, the state of science and technology gives us the ability to recognize complex challenges and work to set site objectives that can be achieved in an agreed-upon time frame. applying an adaptive site management approach can help us as regulators, as stakeholders, responsible parties, to find a path to achieve common goals. It looks like we've achieved our objectives today. Most of you have decided and in our poll said that you would recommend using adaptive site management at your site. And I assume that's whether you consider your site complex or not, adaptive site management might be an approach that you would be willing to consider. Okay, thanks. Now, finally, what actions can you take to make progress at your complex site? We've come to the end of the training here. We now want to prepare you to take action to make a difference at your site. And we also want to encourage you to provide feedback and success stories to ITRC, as Juliana has outlined. The guidance in Chapter 2 will help you to think through site challenges, both technical and non-technical. And to we would hope you'd sit down with others and make a list of those challenges. The 8 questions that Chuck presented, the questions in the matrix, are an example of remediation potential assessment that you can apply at your site. More details on this process are in Chapter 3. We finally hope that applying site management process is a key takeaway, and we hope this concept leads you to think a little differently about your path to reaching your final site objectives. That would include setting interim objectives and establishing performance expectations as a basis for making future decisions throughout remedy implementation and long-term management. And we hope you'll use this guidance that includes stakeholder involvement and use case studies as a resource to see how they've approached similarly complex problems. And we hope also that you'll schedule periodic evaluations of your remedy performance to track that progress and make improvements. Now, with that, we'll turn it back over to our moderator, Juliana, for a second question and answer period. Juliana?
Thanks, Carl. We do now have time for questions, so everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. We also have a couple of final poll questions to answer. One of them is the one that Carl had up just a few slides ago, so here's a little more time to answer that question. Would you recommend using adaptive site management at your site? Also, thinking about the projects that you're working on in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And so we do have that set so that we can see how others in our audience are answering that question as well as your answer. Again, if you're welcome to send in questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right. We do look for everyone on the call today to fill out our feedback form. We really do use the feedback that you provide. Not only are we going to improve today's class, we're also going to use this information. We are developing several new classes, and we read your feedback, and we apply that information when we're working with trainers on our new courses. So let us know what's worked, what hasn't worked. If you have other ideas, we really do use the feedback that you provide. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate. If you have another person at your location, there's an opportunity for you to go back, put that next person's name in, and submit again so you can have certificates for everyone who attended at your location. Several questions have come in. Wouldn't this approach be applicable to most sites?
Yeah, this is Chuck.
I'll take a stab at that.
It is, and
I just had this one anecdote. We were doing the training and saying it's this sort of divides all sites into two buckets, but the feedback came back. I think it was Buddy Beeler that said, no, this really can apply to a whole range of sites. And so maybe if you've got some sort of tank tank and you're going to excavation, maybe there's less applicability for it. But for a wide range of sites, this whole philosophy of adaptive site management, which sort of has its roots, I think, in Terzaghi and in geotechnical work.
sort of this iterative approach moving forward
can be very valuable at most sites.
A question that we asked in the first Q&A, would co-mingling of plumes from multiple sites at different stages of remediation be considered complex? And we've had an addition to that question where the state has different criteria for the same constituents based on the source, dry cleaner versus manufacturing. So does that make that a complex site?
This is Roy. I'll expand. It definitely complicates things a lot more. I've been involved in enough litigation to know the finger-pointing becomes quite dramatic when you have two clearly identifiable sources and then, of course, two different regulatory structures to deal with that. I think the definition, and I said this during my session, we don't want people to get hung up on the term complex site. It really is about understanding the site challenges and how you're utilizing and integrating those site challenges in developing both site objectives and interim objectives. Chuck had provided the remediation potential assessment as a way to help gauge and feel where you are in that spectrum of very complex to less complex. And he noted just now how you could really apply this adaptive site management to almost any type of site, and that's true. The only caution I would add to what Chuck had said is that sometimes you may find yourself in a situation where those may want to use adaptive site management as a trial and error, and NRC itself had cautioned on that happening. And you want adaptive site management to always forward the ability to achieve a site objective or interim objective. What you would try to avoid is having it be a means to have endless and perhaps ill-founded use of technology or techniques that don't necessarily get you that much closer, or the cost and resources involved to it don't necessarily match to what you would achieve out of that. And that's Sam Brock, I think, touched upon that in evaluating performance metrics as well.
I would piggyback on that, Roy, is the fact that anytime we build a remedy, we want it to work. But at complex sites, the level of effort, the sophistication of the professional evaluations and investigations that are required exponentially get more demanding. And so really, we would advocate systematic planning, data quality objectives, a clear vision of the questions that have to be answered, a systematic evaluation of what data are required to answer those questions, and then a follow-up process that keeps the activities on track. And that, in my mind, applies from characterization through execution.
What is the best way to document an adaptive management approach in the ROD? If conditions change, then documenting in too much detail might end up having to do a ROD amendment.
Well, this is Roy. If I could step in on that one, having been involved in a few ROD amendments, as well as discussions on explanation of significant differences, if you look closely at our flowchart, which is called Figure 1 in the guidance, it's really trying to set itself up to anticipate the types of contingencies that you may need. So while you're still going to be doing your performance evaluation and optimization, what the recommendation comes out to is, if you're under CERCLA and you have a ROD, is you'd want to get some of those contingent items into your ROD rather than having to do a ROD amendment on the back end or an ESD, by able to have a contingent remedy or even an upfront TI waiver, which is rare but can occur. What you're doing is you're getting all the parties, the regulators, the responsible parties, and the stakeholders. You give that transparency to the site of recognizing what the challenges are upfront and knowing that there is uncertainty, and you put in these contingencies to address and be able to smoothly transition to that, to the next technology or approach that Mike Truex had not noted in a transition assessment as well. So, again, my recommendation would be if you follow this process, you would optimally be able to integrate a lot of that into the ROD up front rather than as an ESD or amendment.
Thank you. On the slide, we do have our links to additional resources, and we've put together some of the links that we've talked about during today's class, so that may be a reference that you want to use after today's training. It also is how you can download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. So if you want the presentation, it is available for you to download, and it's on that links page. Also, a reminder on the feedback form, we really do use the information and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. I'd like to thank you for filling out our poll questions. On the right, you can scroll down to see some of the answers that have come in. So thank you all for sending in some answers. We have some answers that they're going to share this flowchart with others. So that's a great way to help share the information and help make things happen. Understand the project conceptual site model, and a wide variety of answers. So you're welcome to scroll through and see those answers as they continue to come in. I want to give us another minute or two to see if any additional questions have come in. If you're in the phone line audience, you are welcome to ask questions out loud. It's #6 to unmute your phone, and this is a great time to jump in with a question. And again, everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A in the lower right. After today's training, we plan to archive this training session, and we'll send you an email with a link to the archive. So again, you're also welcome to share this training archive with others. We also plan to offer the class again later this year. It appears we're out of questions, so I'd like to go ahead and wrap up today. If you do have a question that you weren't able to get in, or if we haven't completely